Hi, this is Patti LuPone.
This is Allison Janney.
This is Matt Ballmer.
This is Donna Murphy.
This is Nia Vardalos.
This is Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
This is Beanie Feldstein.
I'm Octavia Spencer.
This is Ben Platt, and you're listening to Little Known Facts with my favorite person on the planet, Alana Levine.
A-OK.
Welcome to Little Known Facts, a podcast where you will hear unfiltered, raw, honest, and uniquely funny interviews with artists you love as they talk about the art they love to make. I'm your host, Ilana Levine.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey, I heard you needed inspiration. He's Alana and friends with some revelations. Little known fact of the day. Every little thing's gonna be A-OK. A-OK.
Hey everyone, new episodes of Little Known Facts drop every Monday and you can find them on your favorite podcast provider. Also, if you go to the website, littleknownfactspodcast.com, you'll find behind-the-scenes photos, videos, and interviews, and lots more on the gallery page. And if you are loving these intimate, candid conversations with all the artists who come on the show, please head over to the contributions page. I depend on these donations to continue to bring you these interviews every week. So if you love the show, please donate. Little known fact about my guest today. When I asked her to tell me about her childhood, she said, well, first we'd have to listen to some Pete Seeger or Arlo Guthrie. Welcome, Sarah Jessica Parker, to the podcast.
This song is called Alice's Restaurant. It's about Alice and the restaurant. But Alice's Restaurant is not the name of the restaurant. That's just the name of the song. And that's why I called the song Alice's Restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant. Walk right in, it's around the back, just a half a mile from the railroad track. And you can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant.
Hey everyone, my guest today is the award-winning actress Sarah Jessica Parker. Sarah became an international star playing Carrie Bradshaw on the HBO television series Sex and the City. She has an extensive list of film credits, including Sex and the City and Sex and the City 2, I Don't Know How She Does It, Smart People, Failure to Launch, The Family Stone, State and Maine, Ed Wood, The First Wives Club, Miami Rhapsody, and Honeymoon in Vegas. She has worked in the theater on and off Broadway since 1976, when she debuted on Broadway in The Innocents, directed by Harold Pinter. Other Broadway credits include the title role in Annie, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Once Upon a Mattress. Off-Broadway credits include the original production of To Jillian on her 37th birthday, Sylvia, and The Commons of Pensacola. She currently stars on the HBO television series Divorce. Her fashion label, SJP, includes shoes and handbags and accessories, and she's the creator of two magnificent fragrances, Lovely and Stash. She's an activist. She's married to actor Matthew Broderick, who also appeared on this podcast. Welcome, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Thank you, Ilana.
Welcome to your own home, where we are doing this interview today.
Thank you for being so patient and waiting for us to find time to do this. I'm so happy.
Me too. And I really feel like everything happens the way it's supposed to. And patience really is a virtue, Sarah, if anybody asks. Watching your work, which is just deeply moving and hilarious in equal parts. I was telling you earlier, I'm such a fan of Divorce, and I was such a crazy fan of Sex and the City. But the thing that really struck me, of all the things I watched in the hundreds of hours as if I was preparing your wing of the Smithsonian, was your first acceptance speech, I think it was in 2000, for the Golden Globe. Mm. And in watching that, which I remember because Cynthia Nixon, as we know, is a dear mutual friend. And so I was watching that year particularly because she was there, was the graciousness with which you accepted that award, the true surprise, the true joy in having won, and also this way in which under pressure you were able to be an ambassador of loveliness and generosity that extended past just your win for acting and producing, but all of the people involved in making something.
I don't remember that, so that's nice to hear, because I think if one is ever fortunate enough to have an opportunity to thank people, to convey gratitude for any acknowledgement, which is never your own, you know, being acknowledged is always involves, when it's work related, is there's no way it doesn't involve at least 100 other people, right? But I think the post moment is spent thinking of all those whose names you didn't mention, or whose work you didn't mention, or whose contribution you didn't mention. And it's sort of a shame, because that's really the thing you most recall from those. So that's really, you know, anytime I've had the good fortune to stand up, I they are, in my estimation, usually missed opportunities, you know.
Well, luckily you've won more than once, so there were multiple opportunities to go back. And by the way, maybe last year I didn't recall. But it makes me think so much about, you know, we were talking before we started raising our children and what the values are that we hope will be their major takeaway beyond grades and, you know, sixth grade anxieties.
Yes.
And so I wanted to go back a little bit with you and talk about, I know many of your siblings, of which there are, you're one of seven.
I'm one of eight.
You're one of eight. You're the one.
I'm one, and then there are seven more.
That's
exactly
right. And just to get a little sense of, I know that you were born in Ohio. So take us back, if you will, to your own
beginnings. Hold on. Let me put some Pete Seeger on.
Thank you.
Or some Arlo Guthrie.
If only we could.
The soundtrack of my childhood. I hope someone turns this around. Has anyone ever interviewed you for your podcast?
No.
Oh, that would be very interesting. You should consider who that person might be. Maybe it should be Talia, for instance, who's a super good interrogator. Because I'd be very interested to ask you the same questions.
Okay.
So I was born in southeastern Ohio in a small coal mining town. The hospital where I was born was in a very teeny town in the foothills of Appalachia called Nelsonville, Ohio.
But wasn't your dad from Brooklyn?
So my father was born and raised in Brooklyn on Ocean Avenue and Avenue S, and a public school student, a keen interest in reading and books and literature. His younger brother, younger baby brother, also a student in public schools in Brooklyn, went on to be an advocate in the children's court in Brooklyn, has since passed. My real father is living. But he made his way to Ohio, ultimately to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where he got his postgraduate degree. But so my parents, when I was born, they were living in Ohio, and he had just gotten his degree and was teaching at Ohio University in Athens, which is a rather bustling city compared to Nelsonville, Ohio. It's the campus, you know, it's the home of the campus of OU. And so I was born in Nelsonville, Ohio. I lived in Athens, Ohio, till I was five. And at 5 years old, my parents were divorced when I was not even 2 years old.
Do you have any memory of them being together?
I do. Strangely enough, I was just talking about it with my mother. I was visiting with my mother on Monday and my stepfather, and they met when I was quite young. They were married in 1968, so they've been together since 68. And I was recalling a memory that my mother said it was a memory shy of two, of her going out one night and leaving me with a babysitter and me screaming. And she said, oh yeah, you wouldn't have been two yet. So my parents divorced, and my mother met my stepfather, and they married on the campus of OU at, I think, a place called Galbraith Chapel, maybe. And we were in the wedding. And then my stepfather's family, as well as my mother's mother, lived in Cincinnati, coincidentally. Paul, my stepfather, was a student at OU. And so we moved, when I was 5 years old, back to Cincinnati, or for my parents, back to Cincinnati. We lived there until I was 11. And on January 1st of 1977, we put everything we owned in a Volkswagen van and moved to New York City. My mother didn't travel because she was pregnant with the seventh baby, Allegra. So she couldn't travel and she was going to close up our house and in Cincinnati. And we came to New York City.
All seven of you, and then the eighth to be born.
So the seventh was to be born.
And what motivated the move?
So it's a sort of long and unusual story, but there was a man in Cincinnati named Tom Robertson. And when we were little, NBC's version of an after-school special was called a Young People Special. And it was on about once or twice a year on NBC. They were made out of Cincinnati. There was this brilliant filmmaker named Tom Robertson who would write and direct these half-hour intended for young audiences specials. And they were on all the NBC stations, but they were produced out of Cincinnati because he was a Cincinnatian. And that we came upon an ad when I was 8 years old in our local newspaper that they were looking for a little girl to play the little match girl in NBC's NBC, you know, Young People Specials version of the little match girl. So I saw it, and my sister and I actually went downtown to our local television station, WLW TV5. Stood in line
in
with 500, and stood in line with 500 other little girls, and we auditioned for the part, and I got the part. It shot for over 5 days in Cincinnati with this brilliant, brilliant DP named Eli Agopian. It was shot on film, of course. He was an Armenian, and it was this incredible experience, and I loved it. And I was eight.
Was this your first time performing?
Correct, yes. I, at that point, had just started studying ballet, as had my sister and my older brother, Toby, who you know, with the Cincinnati Ballet Company, which at the time was a really well-regarded company. And they had a beautiful ballet school as part of their company, a sort of farm system, if you will. So I did that. And meanwhile, Toby was auditioning for things in Cincinnati and getting jobs and going on the road. And then when I was 11, Toby and I did also for Tom Robertson another Young People special called Nightmare, The Immigration of Joachim and Rachel.
I love that. Remember I said I'd watched all of your footage this week? I would say it's not just the Golden Globe that I love, but really it's the Joachim story.
Nightmare, The Immigration of Joachim and Rachel. And it was the story of two children escaping the Warsaw Ghetto and coming to New York to, you know, very distant relations who were going to take them. Beautiful. And while we shot that, there was an ad in the paper, once again, that there was a Broadway play coming to New York, a play called The Innocents, directed by Harold Pinter, and they were looking for children. And we were going to go to New York to see my father. So we traveled to New York that summer, and Toby and I auditioned for the part. And initially, we were first cast as the understudies for the two children. And once they started rehearsals, they discovered that the girl they cast was too young. And so they called me in and I flew to London with my stepfather. And I took over in London. And Toby got to perform it when we came to Broadway. So after we finished that and we came back to New York, my stepfather wanted to start a trucking business in New York that would transport Broadway shows on the road. So that is what allowed us to come to New York with a somewhat concrete plan. I mean, it was not fleshed out.
Yeah.
We didn't really have any certainty that there was work or employment or even money. We had been fortunate enough to apply very early for the subsidized housing on Roosevelt Island before it was built. My parents had read an article in New York Magazine on this place in the middle of the East River that would create lots of affordable housing because we couldn't move to New York. We couldn't afford to live in New York, but that would give us the proximity we needed to the city. So we came to New York on January 1st to discover that the apartments weren't ready. So my father looked in the New York Times and he found a house for rent. We first lived in the Holiday Inn in Yonkers for a while.
Oh my God!
Literally with when I'm telling you like pots and pans, like sometimes my dad would stop short on like I-75 and we'd have to put our hands back to keep the skillet from like flying forward and hitting us in the head.
It was real.
Yeah.
It was real. And so when this is happening, because I'm just picturing my kids and their ages and sort of where you guys were, and without your mom, by the way.
Yeah. Without the person that really created any order in our lives, mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's a, I never considered that before, because my father had six kids in the back seat. Six kids and all of our freaking junk. It's just a massive undertaking.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine, first of all, I can imagine my mom was thrilled. I mean, I don't know that she'd been in a house alone in
the quiet,
what, 15 years, because Pippin was 15. But she must have been like wondering constantly what was happening. Was anybody washing their face or brushing their teeth or saying, yeah, please, thank you. Like, you know,
the things that are important to her.
Yeah.
I don't know how well you remember this time, but was it...
Vividly.
Vividly. Okay. So tell me, terrifying, exciting?
Oh, I was excited. I was counting the days down till we were leaving for some good reasons, some really lousy reasons. Like, I knew I didn't have to finish any of my homework over the Christmas break because it didn't matter because I wasn't going back. And I love New York. Ultimately, when the Innocents came to New York, we went, you know, we played out of town in Boston, Philadelphia, and we came to New York, and it was not successful. I couldn't believe I went back, and I couldn't believe that I had been in New York and I had lived there. And I remember saying to Toby, can you believe we were in New York City today and now we're back?
Surreal.
In our tiny little beautiful town. By the way, Cincinnati is a absolutely fantastic city. But I was done. Like, I was in my head, I was like, that's where I'm going to be and that's where I want to be. So I was really excited. I think all of us were. I mean, I think uncertainty had been so much a part of our lives that we had integrated it so well into our beings. Uncertainty about money or housing or basic necessities were, there was a question mark constantly about, can we reach this goal this month, you know? But maybe that allowed for us to be ready for anything, any adventure. I mean, there were some children that were making bigger sacrifices, like Rachel, who was not, I believe, intending to be a performer, was like uprooting herself. She was a great student. She was in a really important school.
Is Rachel younger than
Rachel's
you?
Older.
Can you just say that?
Yeah. So it goes Pippin, Toby, Rachel, me, Andrew, Megan, Allegra, and Aaron. Allegra was yet not born. Aaron wasn't born. Megan was the baby. She was seven when Allegra was born. So there was a big gap. So Rachel was, in lots of ways, giving up the most. Mm. My mom was giving up the most because she had a big, full, rich life in Cincinnati, came to New York, didn't know a soul. But I think we were really excited. We loved the city. We loved the theater. We loved museums. We loved the subway.
Did you know your biological dad's family here?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
And did you kind of continue to have a relationship with your real dad and your stepdad?
We did. I mean, it wasn't consistent. There wasn't any kind of proper system in place for like visitation, especially because he lived far away from us. But we saw our grandparents a nice amount. They eventually retired to Florida and to Century Village.
Perfect.
And we were very friendly with them and certainly in contact with our father. But he lived in Philadelphia by then. He had moved to Philadelphia in the mid-70s.
And did he remarry and have another family?
He did. He remarried in 1984 and is still married. He didn't have more children, but he has a wonderful wife. Yeah, Karen, great wife.
The first two directors you're describing that you worked with, like, talk about being spoiled forever, right?
Yeah.
The extraordinary luck of those early jobs being with people who were just such artists.
Yeah.
It's such a luck of the draw in that way.
Definitely. And professionals, you know, really diligent about work. You know, Tom Robertson obviously was different because the environment in which he was working was not like an industry town, but he created, you know, we shot this show in 5 days, Monday through Friday, and it was done.
Like Somerset, in a way.
And then when I worked with Harold Pinter, with Harold came Claire Bloom. And I think that's the really important person to talk about in a way, because when you talk about the good fortune, I mean, first of all, well, I was the minute I met Harold Pinter, I was literally like in love with him. Like, I can't explain it because I was 11 years old. Well, first of all, I'd seen plays of him at the, of his at the Cincinnati Playhouse in the park. They had done his plays and we were subscribers. So we went to all the theater there and they always had New York actors come in and do these great. Do you know the Cincinnati Playhouse at all?
No.
Oh, it's a great regional theater and it's like, you know, won a Tony for its work. So I knew some Pinter plays and I think my stepdad had been Stanley the waiter in, what's the one? I can't remember. I can't remember. So I knew who Harold Pinter was. He was beautiful, physically, absolutely dashing, and British, brilliant. You just knew, like, if you grew up in a house where literature was important and like radio, culture, I can't explain it. And, you know, he always smelled like cigarettes and his beautiful cologne, whatever like fragrance he wore.
Stash. Wasn't it Stash?
Yes. And, you know, cocktails by nighttime and just smart. And then Claire Bloom was this like extraordinary, gifted, magical bird, which I didn't know her work, but by the time we were working together, I would stand backstage, and this is really like remained so important to me. I used to stand by the big speakers back then. They had big speakers backstage to amplify the sound. So whatever system they had in place, there was a massive speaker off both stage left and stage right, and I would stand by the speaker and like lean into it and just listen to her voice because she had the most beautiful diction and pronunciation, and her accent was like perfect, you know. But she was a real professional, and she said to me early on, she took a liking to me. I used to come to her dressing room while she got ready and watch her put her makeup on and everything, and she used to say to me, do not become a professional child. I won't have anything to do with you. Don't turn out like all those other child actors. It's no good for you. You'll never get better. And I was like,
my son's 11. So thinking of an 11-year-old brain, did you intuit what she meant by that?
Completely. I don't know why, but I think you would have too. Maybe because it was the person telling me. Maybe if somebody else had said it and I didn't admire them so much, it would not have stuck.
Right, but this resonated.
But I was like, whatever I think that means, I better make sure I don't do it. You know?
So you're on Broadway.
Not for long.
Okay. Well, sadly. Well, kid. Joe's is filled with walls that have posters like, yeah. That's all part of it, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, how does someone so young heal the broken heart that is, I have worked so hard. Yeah. We have made this thing. This is Harold Pinter.
Yeah.
This was in England and London, and now it's coming to New York, and it is not being received with the love that it has been made of.
You know, when you're little and there's not as much at stake,
yeah.
The cut isn't as deeply felt, I think. I was sad to leave it and have to go back to Cincinnati because we hadn't yet, you know, that was the summer before we moved.
This is pre-Roosevelt Island.
This is pre-Roosevelt Island.
Holiday,
so I
right.
was sad to have to go back, not to the town and to the people, but to not have the experience every night of going to the theater. It was at the Marasco Theater, which is sadly gone now. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful, beautiful, tiny little theater. They knocked it down to build the new hotel, the 44th and 45th Street.
I can't believe like you're with your brother in that experience. Like,
I think we were both disappointed for that reason, you know, and also because Harold got sick and his doctor wouldn't let him travel to Philadelphia and Boston. So he kind of snuck out and came, but we were without a director mm-hmm. for a little while. So I think that was problematic for everybody, you know? So when it was over, I mean, when the reviews were not good, I only gleaned from everybody else's eyes that it was like not just bad, but it was bad and that we wouldn't last. And I couldn't really believe that because I was like, well, I don't understand, you know, what's required money-wise to keep going. We're all willing to show up.
Yeah,
so what's the difference, you know? But I'm grateful for that limited time spent doing that, I'll take that over not having done it at all.
Was Annie the next opportunity to be on Broadway and mm-hmm. to live that life again?
The next thing I did, I came back to New York and I right away auditioned for something called the Milliken Breakfast Show, which was a big trade show, which all the dancers on Broadway did. So I did that first. And that was with like all the Broadway people. Then I auditioned in late 77 for Annie. Right after the show opened on Broadway, they started a national tour and the first person was leaving to go play Annie on the road. So they needed someone to fill her spot as an orphan. So I had seen Annie right when it opened, like everybody else I had followed, we would always read every article in the Sunday paper because there were endless articles about this show and those kids. And I had worked with a bunch of the kids on the Milliken Breakfast Show because they had been doing Annie and doing the Milliken Breakfast Show, which is something you could do. When I saw the show, my stepdad said to me, because we got like two seats and two standing room or three seats and three standing room. And after the show, my dad said to me, you know, you're not Annie material. You know, you'll never be in the show. And I was like, no, I know that. You know, I could see what they were doing and I didn't have any of those
because
skills.
Did he see it as like, that's Broadway. That's yeah. Broadway singing yeah. and dancing. And,
yeah, exactly. Right. And I had done one other musical, the Milliken Breakfast Show, but I'd struggled through the dance audition part. Like I was a ballet dancer. I wasn't a show dancer and I didn't like belt, you know? And so when I auditioned, I knew it was a long shot, but then I ended up getting it. So, yeah. So maybe they were looking for a different type.
I don't know if people understand what that would be like, maybe being like president, but if you're of a certain age, right? Annie, I mean, everyone talks about Hamilton now and it's incredible yeah. in a very different way. And yeah. I'm not comparing the book and the lyrics of Annie to Hamilton in exactly the same way, but in terms of what it was to be a young person
yes.
and to see yourself age-wise on stage yeah. and tons of people your own age yeah. on stage and this kind of heartbreaking story.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a perfectly put together
I think
musical.
It's a perfect show. And I've told Matthew, who didn't get to see that original production, which I'm like, you know, where were you? What parent, what grown-up didn't take you yeah. to see that freaking show?
Well, that's another show, isn't it?
It's, yes.
Yeah, to talk about that. Where were the parents?
Yes, because yeah. it really is. I think it's there are a lot of perfect musicals. You know, we know what they are. But Annie is among them. And I never imagined, you know, that first night when I was, because I first was cast as an orphan. I played an orphan for a year and I came in also as the understudy to Annie and then I played Annie for a year. But that first night when I was actually really on stage, not just in the put-in rehearsal, but actually in the real thing, and it was a huge snowstorm, the biggest snowstorm in New York in 30 years or 36 years. And so a lot of people were out that night. So they were like, you might have to go on for Annie tonight and you might have to do a bunch of other people's tracks as well.
And we might need you to sit in the audience too. So it looks
literally,
fuller.
Yeah. But I remember being backstage before the curtain went up and looking at the ground and looking at the tape, you know, of all the where the sets go, you know it well, looking at the signatures, because at that point in that was the Alvin Theater, everybody would sign the back of the curtain, like movie stars that had come, and yeah. Andrea had signed it, and people always left notes on the back burlap of that massive fire curtain, and the black, and there was the moving sidewalk, you know, so it was all wooden slats that were on a conveyor, and thinking like, I cannot believe I'm here. I cannot believe it. Like way more so than The Innocents, because
sure.
The Innocents had nothing in front of it. It was no point of reference.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't seen The Innocents.
It was not yet a phenomenon.
Yeah.
This love of performing and this love of storytelling, and you're so good at it. Like how lucky.
Sometimes.
Right?
Sometimes I'm not. Sometimes
well,
I'm short.
We'll talk about that.
Lots of times, how
you get up again the next day.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's so embarrassing
yeah, yeah.
to do it publicly.
Yeah. Wish you could do it privately.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it's just easier.
Yeah.
But what is that? Where was that coming from?
I'm not sure I understand exactly its provenance. And I think a lot of us, yourself included, I think it's a hard thing to explain because, well, part of it's just I think the house that I grew up in, which was, you know, we didn't have a television, so we were always listening to records and imagining everything. We listened to records all the time, and not just music. We listened to a lot of musicals. We also listened to comedy records, you know, Sam Friedberg and Nichols and May and Bob Newhart and Richard Pryor. We also listened to the radio all the time, like NPR, you know, from the time I can remember. So I think a lot of our time was spent in our heads, like imagining things. We put on a lot of shows, not good shows or anything. I've heard of other houses of kids doing like really good shows. Yeah. Ours are, but it was definitely a house where creativity and culture were dominant. We went to the theater in Cincinnati as much as possible. We went to the symphony all the time, even though we hated it and we were bored out of our minds. We had a great museum. We went to the museum all the time, every weekend. We went to the ballet.
And are you having access to all this? I mean, having kids in public school, I'm aware of all of the amazing places they get to go and visit. But you're also describing a childhood where finances were limited. How are you going to the ballet and the symphony and taking all these classes? And how is all of this happening simultaneously?
Well, it was a different time in our government, so we had a lot of federal funding for the arts, and that included often programs for children, access for children to museums, to theater, to ballet. So there was that, and my mom was very industrious and very intrepid about like finding out every freaking opportunity to have access for her children to the arts. So there was that. She applied for scholarships for us for the ballet, and they granted them if we maintained a certain grade point average.
Right.
So there was that. Our public schools, and she was probably part of this, also were audiences at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park. So all the kids in public schools got to go to see plays at appropriate plays at the Playhouse. Our symphony orchestra, I'm sure she bought tickets on a sliding scale. I'm sure she found the cheapest seats. I know they were way in the back. She just thought we should be listening to live classical music and opera. And she always said to us at the symphony and the opera and the museum, which was equally boring a lot of the time, she's like, bring a book. And if you're like, if you can't read, bring a book anyway. She's like, I will leave you on that bench and I will come back and I will check in. You can sit on this bench around this art. You'll absorb it somehow. As she would say at the symphony, you can bring a book. You are allowed to read while the music is playing.
Right.
And so I think we grew up with that, and especially if you're not a student. Like, I never considered myself a student. I didn't like it. It gave me anxiety. I felt nauseous before tests. You know, I think for so many children in this country, like me, maybe like you, imagining other people's lives is just interesting. And the thing about it is, it doesn't mean you don't like your own life, that you're not completely invested in your own, or you're looking for a means of escape. To be somebody else, even when you can't do it, to try to be somebody else, to imagine, and when you have big stretches of years where you get to actually be somebody else and spend more time playing them than yourself, I think that's just unbelievable. Like, that's why I love books so much, because yeah. I'm gone. And I love my own life and living it. But I think that's it. It's just cultivating a desire for stories is, I think, a lot to do with the home environment. You know, a grown up in a child's life, in school, in the library, in a church, somebody in a child's life promoting storytelling, I think is invaluable for lots of reasons, none of which have to do with pursuing a professional career.
Right.
Just the ability to let person be in their brain and imagine other things. I also think it just creates, as you've said, that this thing that's so important to you for your children, this to be a person of empathy, to connect, to not connect, to wonder why we don't connect, to be curious about other people who look different, smell different, act different. You know, I think that's what comes from stories and knowing and trying to figure out things out. So I think that's why I like it.
So this is a big jump, but everything started out in this kind of incremental way where you could get a part and learn and then do the next one and learn, or starting as a replacement where you're watching and you get to kind of do someone else's track.
Right.
Which I actually love, not having to have a review
with my name in it. It's so great.
You're like, you know what? I will replace the day after you open. I don't even care. I just want to rehearse.
Couldn't agree with you more.
The idea of actually having to then have judges be part of the experience is really hard. And, you know, I know that you sort of built a life in the theater, and then you had this wonderful moment on a sitcom called Square Pegs, mm-hmm. which brought you to California. Now you're on a TV show. You were very funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had a great comedic, you kind of started out as the hilarious best friend, right? In certain things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in films, I remember Lots L.A. Story. Like, I just remember you having this, I don't know, this, like, unbelievably comfortable comedic elegance in small things and big things with people who were comedy masters holding your own very quickly. I mean, you and Steve Martin are...
I did everything I could to be ready for that, though. Like, once I got that part, I was just like, well, I already loved, I mean, being close in age, like that he had played such a huge role in our entertainment.
Yes, watching Steve
like,
Martin on Saturday Night Live
exactly.
and his films. And
all of his, you know, all the ways in which his body was as much a part of it. So I was just...
Meaning very physical humor.
His physical humor. So I went back and I like watched as much of his stuff as I could before we started shooting to try to better understand why he'd written this part, which, you know, any of those parts that allowed that for, as an actor were in large part the writing. I think anybody that would have been given those same opportunities would have found the same satisfaction mm-hmm. in doing it. And the audience would have liked them as much as they liked me. The parts were so well written. They were so clear. They didn't always give you the blueprint for the physical work, but it, you know, like, that part in L.A. Story was absolutely perfectly written. Perfectly written. And then you just work hard to be deserving. And most people I know, most people you know, do the same.
With Sandy, mm-hmm. from how you describe how she writes her name to kind of twirling around all the time. You know, it's one thing to go, I wish if I got this part, you know what I would do? But to do that in an audition situation... Not everyone can bring it with confidence in that way.
I couldn't either often. I mean, auditions are, you should do endless series. Just, yeah. I know you talk about it, but, you know, sometimes you manage in an audition and sometimes you don't. And for some reason, and once again, I do think it's the writing. For some reason, I just understood her. She's not a character I ever would have. Up to that point, no one ever cast me as like the girl that men would be attracted to. Like never. Yeah. And I guess whatever he put on the page was enough for me to figure it out. Cause I auditioned for that many times and then had one or two screen tests with Steve. And when I got the part, Mick Jackson was the director of that movie. And I just thought, I'll just be physical all the time. And someone will tell me, stop it, you know, if it's not. And at a certain point, Mick Jackson had a megaphone in some of those big scenes that were in big public spaces. And he would just, he was British, and he would say, you know, and rolling and Sarah Jessica bounce, like through a megaphone. Literally, it was like, got it, understood. We all understood.
Did that make you feel good?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's like, but that's a whole other conversation. It's like when you feel supported, then you'll try anything because it just doesn't occur to you not to.
And you're working for artists who appreciate that
yes,
and want collaboration.
Exactly.
The thing that happened with Sex and the City, in case you're not clear what happened, is that all of this work you did on stage and screen kind of all came to this point where all of the best things that you do came together in Carrie.
Or maybe, too, I think the things that because I'm not sure, you know, I think at a certain point, it's hard to know when you're working on a show for a long time at what point this other flip happens and the writers start
writing for you.
Right.
And your strengths.
Right. And for all of us.
So when you look at the pilot, and look then at the pilot, see where it went over the years.
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know why Darren thought of me for this show, why he, you know, when we met, he said, you know, I kept hearing your voice in my head as he was writing the pilot, my voice, which did honestly, sincerely, did not make any sense to me because she was so, I never played a character like that. And
well, what do you think he meant or what had he seen or did you know him?
I think he'd seen Honeymoon in Vegas maybe and LA Story. I knew who he was, but I didn't, we'd not met. And I was just, I think he quickly, because he was with us for the first season, I think, you know, it was my job to make it work if I said yes. And like, that's the responsibility. So I think what happens at that point, and you've done it and you've seen it and you're around it, is everybody starts kind of working together. And I don't even know that there's a conversation that says, okay, everybody, now we're going to work together and I'll bring everything I can and you're going to bring all the things I can't bring with words. And so I think in the best of circumstances on a television series, that happens quickly and without a lot of conversation. And I think Darren is an intuitive person. I think one of his many strengths as a producer is putting people together. Like, he's a great producer that way, and yanking from people. And then in his case, the great thing that happened was that he left to go on do other things and he turned that show over to Michael. And I think that's when
Michael Patrick King,
we got to go real deep. Like, that was his interest in the show, was starting to like really mine the possibilities. And I think that's when you really see this adhesive thing happen between story and actor. You get to see Cynthia just rip it up. And Kristen, you know, all these archetypal characters get to go down, as Scotty Whitman likes to say, to the basement. Like, you want basement. And so I think, back to your question, is I think you spend a lot of years doing something and then you have some confidence and skill, even if you're not trained. You have some stuff. And then if you're fortunate, then you get to tell a story that you can start really, right?
So just to, is it dovetail or continue on? So training, you started as a really young kid performing in public. Mm-hmm. It would have been impossible for you to have the technique or craft built or to even know how to work beyond intuition.
Right.
I think at this point, there's a way in which there's a fluidity between theater and film and stage. That's what's gotten so great about work now. It doesn't feel like that's a play and that's a TV show. And yet, I don't think you went to college. I think you just have been working.
I was going to. I mean, I thought about it. I visited a couple of schools, but then I was working.
And right.
So then I just kept working. And
you're a journeywoman. And you've been working a long time.
And that was, you know, my goal was to be considered a journeyman or journeywoman.
So how do you work? Where do you feel most comfortable?
Well, I always say I don't really have a process, but I don't really think that's true anymore, because I think no matter what your profession is in life, whatever, I think everybody has a process by this age, you know? You know, so I don't have any formal training. I don't have any classical training, which I regret, just because I never have done like the classics in my life. But I think my process is I don't like to talk too much about interior life. I don't like to discuss subtext. I can't bear it. I'm fine if everybody else wants to talk about it. I don't care what anyone else's process is.
But when you're sitting around the table, when there's that
I don't
kind
like
of rehearsal
to say
or
too much. I don't like when scenes are challenging emotionally to have anybody tell me what they believe some interior or past or what is informing. Like, I would like to be able to count on the story. Because I don't have training, I don't like to connect. I'm not good at connecting technical with emotional. So the talking tends to be, feels technical to me. And I would prefer to simply sit across, preferably from a good actor, and respond.
You know, it's funny, when I asked Matthew Broderick, your husband, you know, we were talking about how not that many people, unless they have to, do the same thing for, you know, since they're very, very young, right? And so what I was like, you must still like it. right? Like you're still getting something out of it, right? You started at 17 and now you're 50 and you're still. And he was kind of talking about, like, especially in the theater, when it all comes together exactly in the way you're describing, like when all of the parts, like a fine Swiss watch, are kind of working together. You can't really put words to it, but there's a satisfaction in the telling of the story.
It's the best.
And the community.
It's the best. It's best, better than any other medium.
It's incredible.
And you know, it's usually, I find, the week after you open. Like, and that you can have had a good experience going into it, rehearsals, great director, great cast, meaning you got so much from this, it's so helpful, made you feel great, made you, you know, push and pull and challenged you, and the cast is the same, and good reviews, bad reviews, whatever. And you can feel that way in the weeks leading up to the bad week. Which everybody has a different way of dealing with. But I find like that week after opening,
and it's
when
yours,
it's yours
again.
Like for real, because there's no other time an actor can say that for sure. Because I know now, having spent so many years in an edit, how much an actor's work is not their own on film. But in the theater, man, it doesn't matter how much you like your director or whatever. Once they are gone,
it's yours.
It is. And when it's working, even in a play that's troubled, it's
ecstasy.
It's like, it must feel like what it feels like for a ball player to be making that perfect sound with the ball hitting the bat, you know, that just series of great games, you know, great plays in the field and great games at bat. And you just can't plan it. You don't know why. Why is it so ephemeral? Why can't I capture it and hold on to it? Why am I not getting this joke right? You know, like, it's the weirdest thing.
But yeah,
that's why I think people work in the theater over and over again, even as painful as it is, and more so every year. The more people that have opinions and voices and online and from the first freaking preview on.
Right.
It's unmatchable in satisfaction.
The thing that happened with Sex and the City, which makes sense and might have happened anyway because of where your career was going at that time, and you were a movie star doing a TV show, which wasn't
I was new. I was getting some decent work, but I don't know if I was a movie star.
Well, I'm going to say you were.
Oh, that's nice. My mom.
I understand.
My mom.
Your lovely mom. That what did happen with that show, and which is so special when you shoot something on location so much of the time, you lived in the location that you were shooting in.
Yeah.
Right? You weren't at a hotel in Atlanta. Yeah. And then when the show was done, you went home to New York City. Yeah. And went back. So everyone in New York felt like, whether they were actually speaking parts on the show or extras, they all felt like they were extras. They all felt ownership in some way of
I'm glad they should have.
But what happened for you is that you became really famous and beloved, and also had to walk the streets among all the people who felt like they were in the show with you.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you negotiate this?
Well, I think for a lot of us, myself and Cynthia, Kim and Kristen, you know, we weren't children, luckily. Like, we were grown women, and I think we were 30 at least. So that, I think, was an enormous advantage. So we were better equipped to handle things, but just because life experience and maturity gives you a little bit of, like, you've got some muscle, you know. And at that point in all of our lives, I think we were, you know, surrounded by people that we trust and loved and who wanted for us the best. So meaning counsel, right?
Were you married to Matthew when you got
that
show?
We got married.
Or together?
The week before we shot the pilot, on the Monday before we started shooting the pilot, the following Monday. So when Darren asked me to do the show, I said, well,
I do.
I said, well, I was like, I was afraid to tell him. I have to tell you, and it's kind of a secret, but I'm getting married and I can't work that day. And because that was around the exact time he wanted to shoot. And I was doing Once Upon a Mattress at the time also. So we were grown-ups, and I think, you know, the first year we weren't even on the air. We shot a whole season, and we were shooting the second season when we went on the air. And I think over time, you know, the show, it cultivated its own place, and I think for me, I'm able to see all the good that came of the exposure, meaning like the burdens of it, you know, being interrupted when you're out with your family or at a meal, or now with phones all the time and cameras and selfies and pictures and the opportunity for a lack of privacy every time you're out on the street. There are times I think that I am able to say to someone, you know, I'm with my children and it's really important that I'm only their parent right now. Like they're just not interested. So I owe you one, mm-hmm. you know, I think I'm better at that because of the children in a way. But I think I also recognize that the times that it feels intrusive, the things that fame brings that feel uninvited, that are byproducts, you have to reconcile these things, because with those came a singular privilege that we share, those four women in total, an experience that will never be duplicated, a story we got to tell that I not one single day regretted telling, whether the story was successful or not. The experience of being on that set every single solitary day was the joy of my professional life. So any of the stuff that feels like, this isn't a good time, or why are they looking at me, or all that stuff, it just is eclipsed by the good, eclipsed by the opportunity, eclipsed by the financial freedom it allowed for many of us to make other choices, to make choices, period, to get to say no to work, to be a parent. And like most working women in this country, I can say, I don't want to do this as a working person because I want to do that. I can afford the kind of childcare I need. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It just goes on and on and on. So you deal with it, because what are you going to do? Be resentful, bitter, speak poorly of something that altered your life in ways that thousands of people far more talented than me are equally as deserving and won't have it? You know, how many talented people do you know that just don't get the work they should, or still worry about paying rent? Like, it's crazy. So all that stuff, yeah, it's annoying sometimes. And yeah, I worry about my kids and trying to be a parent with them. I mean, that's the hard stuff, is like I'm out with the kids and they don't find it scary. They find it intrusive. It feels annoying to them because they want me to themselves. They want to think of me simply as their parent. I have explained to them that if this is the cross they have to bear, there are far worse things.
Sure.
There are children, like, we need not go into that.
Yeah.
And because of that thing, sometimes we get to go to really special places or meet somebody we might want to meet or go to an opening night of a show because, mm-hmm. you know, so everybody has to find a place for it in their life, but they don't have to find it in the way that I do. And I can say to people, I have to be a parent now. You know?
And they respect that for the most part.
For the most part, they respect it.
Do your kids have any inclination or desire to be performers? And how would you reconcile that, having done it yourself as a kid? Yeah. At a different time, obviously. The exposure was different. And
yeah.
The vulnerabilities are different in terms of what we're talking about
yeah.
right now. Has that come up?
It has in passing. There was a moment where I think James Wilkie thought he wanted to try it. He was in Theater for a New City. He did their production of A Christmas Carol for a couple years. But the truth is, he said to me later, there was during that period, he was like, I wish you would let me audition. And I said, here's the thing. You can audition after school. You're not going to miss school. You don't need to miss school. You got to do it. Why can't I? And I said, because I didn't also get to be the student. I wasn't the student you were. And mm-hmm. I didn't have the opportunities in schools that you've had. You're a student. And later he said, I'm so glad. He's such a student. And, you know, and if my daughter Loretta or Tabitha thinks for a moment they want to, I indulge it and say, great. One day after you finish college, you can pursue anything. I think it's wonderful. Try it all. I just don't have any interest in them being actors right now. I just think it's way too complicated for children today. Way
yeah.
too complicated. And there's too much that I think is inhospitable and unfriendly and I just didn't. I don't think I would have the I don't have the constitution even to be on Twitter myself, let alone have anybody talk about my kids.
Yeah,
you know
yeah,
what
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah. Speaking of auditions, does any come to mind?
When we came to New York to audition for The Innocents, we, you know, sent a letter because they said they were looking for children and these were the ages. And my dad, my stepdad, took us to the park and like he took a headshot of us or whatever, and we sent it in and they said, sure, you know, if you want to come to New York on your own dollar and you want to come by and audition, that's great. And so we showed up and we showed up at a man named Arthur Kantor, who was a huge Broadway producer. Like his name was on the door. It was like old fashioned, you know, I think it was like in 15 something Broadway,
yeah,
you know,
on an old wooden door and
with the glass.
Glass.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we walked in and at the time the production stage manager, who was Mitch Erickson, who was a legendary PSM, and his assistant, Johnny Handy, also legendary, were there and in Mr. Cantor's office. And the first thing that they said to Toby and to me was, here, these scripts aren't collated. You guys sit down and collate these scripts, and then we'll do some of your audition scenes. So the having just like literally driven once again in that bus to New York City, knock, knock, knock. Oh yes. Come in, kids, sit down and collate these scripts and then you can audition. So that was the first thing, which as I was like, interesting. I was like, what does collate mean? I auditioned for a soap opera once, I'm remembering now, and that was a very bad situation. What's the one that filmed in Brooklyn that we all auditioned for all the time? Was it Another World or As the World Turns?
I think it was As the World Turns.
Is that possible?
Yeah.
So I think I auditioned for that one. The director kept taking phone calls during my audition. Really rude, I will say now. I've never said this before because I didn't want to hurt his feelings. And I'm well, if he's living or not. But I found him to be so rude and so dismissive and kept talking through my audition and was very unfriendly. And then I got the part anyway, but I kept saying, well, should I stop? Because you're on the phone. And he would motion with his hand, you know, keep going, keep going. But I was like, but how do you hear me if you're on the phone? It was a big office. It was like a cliche.
Yeah.
You know, it was a dismissive, diminishing man. And then I got the part, and I remember nobody helped me. I got to that studio, you know, you're starving.
Yeah,
and
it's
like
a huge cavern,
and 4
in the
morning, and you don't know where anything is, and you don't know who anybody is, and they're screaming for you, show up, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker, show up at the blah, blah, for a dry block or whatever these things are called.
I don't know what it is or where it is.
Running. Where? And then the mad at me when I got there, where I was like, well, no one,
no one got me.
No one got me. I don't know where I am. Trying to understand that language quickly. You know, there's like a whole language that's related to working on a soap opera, just the technical stuff. And I'm trying to think of other audition stories. I mean, I don't know. There's so many.
But don't you think those experiences are exactly why, as a producer, you create a whole other world for the people?
I try.
Right?
Yeah. I can't. I mean, I always want to be at auditions because...
So you can take a call.
So I can, exactly.
You can eat,
oh my God.
Take a call.
I can't do anything. Auditions are so... I can't bear it. I would... If I could wrap my arms around every single person and personally carry them out of the room. Right. First of all, I have a really weird thing about when they... Anybody leaving an audition has to walk to the door and they... Their back is to the people for whom they've just
read.
Gave everything that they had.
Yeah. Five pints of blood.
I can't bear it. For some reason, the walk to the door, I literally can't bear it. Like, I literally cry constantly on auditions because it doesn't seem fair that they should have to leave us with their back to us.
Right.
Like, if there was a way, I try to walk them to the door so they can see my face and I can say, that was, oh my God, that was so good and thank you. And thank you. And you're making this hard for us. And, you know, like, and the same with writers. I remember we were meeting with writers for, Divorce or I can't remember another show we were producing. And I was like, why do any of these people who are like been around, why do any of them have to come and meet with us? Like, why did we have to do this to them? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't bear it. I don't know why. But I don't want to not be there because I want to make sure that every single person feels appreciated and respected. Yeah.
Right. Well, this is my last question for you. How did you come up with the names of those two fragrances? Because I stay up at night trying to think of names of fragrances I don't make. I don't have a business. My children are Georgia and Caleb. I think they are perfect. The most beautiful names.
Yeah.
I will leave today like, why didn't I use Tabitha? Like, I'm still, Loretta, that's an amazing name.
I know.
Name.
I always want more kids just because I've been keeping just names for names. So long.
Yes, and I think they're good, but I'll like, never I'll be able hear to like, I'm sorry, did you say
Luther.
Your name is Raul?
Yes.
Oh my God, Raul Famusa. That would have been amazing.
I know.
So,
but the last name is what's like, you know what I mean?
Well, it's, I mean, no one will ever know that they're Jewish is all I can say.
But to answer your question,
yeah,
lovely. So very quickly, my mom always wore fragrance when I was a little girl and she didn't go, well, she actually did go out a lot, but she always like put fragrance on before she left the house and we would always be downwind of her, you know, as she was leaving. And even though I didn't love my mother's fragrance and it often gave me a headache, I loved the nostalgic, the memory, you know what fragrance does. Like it takes you right back. The same with music or,
my grandmother wore Shalimar and it's like,
oh yeah,
it's right here.
It's right. Yeah, yeah. Like it's so immediate.
Yeah.
And, I just loved fragrance. And so, before I started doing Sex and the City, I started keeping names of fragrance because in my head, because I started wearing fragrance pretty early in life and saved money and like would buy fragrance. And I know every fragrance I wore up until Lovely. I just kept names of fragrances. And when I did Lovely, I said to the company I was working with at the time, Cody, I said, I know this is crazy and I'm sure it's taken already, but my first name choice is Lovely because like what a better name for fragrance because it like says everything, like it's a polite fragrance, it's not too intrusive, you know, if you hug someone wearing Lovely it doesn't stay on, like everything about it is so well behaved, it's lovely.
Yes.
And sure enough the name was available and I was like, what, all boom. These fragrance magnets in the world didn't use Lovely. And then Stash came because it was something that I've been working on for a really long time and it was all the components were very expensive and the juice was everything about it was like prohibitive, but the company that I was working with, which I still do, a company named IFF here in New York, a fragrance house that's amazing, they would put it together for me. But at the time we hadn't put the components in one bottle, so I would have these three different bottles of the components of this fragrance, so sort of pillars of it. And I was like, it's like Stash. It's like contraband. It's like passing along something that's illegal. And that would be
so
my,
good.
It's so good. So that's how it came.
And that's how it came.
Yeah.
To be sitting here in this absolutely, this is what I want to say about Sarah Jessica Parker's house, because not all of you will have the chance to sit in it. Although if you watch
you
Vogue 73 Questions,
oh, that's right.
You get to see little snippets of
yes,
it.
Yes.
The words that are coming to mind are informal elegance. The idea that every piece is so beautiful and every piece of art, it is stunningly beautiful, but I've never felt more comfortable.
It doesn't look like Sanford and Son to you?
It, in the best way.
I'm like, this is a house of junk. It's a house of junk.
I'm coming. No, but like
you're
it's
nice
the
to
prettiest
say so.
Blue I've ever seen. It's not quite Tiffany. It's gorgeous.
A lot of it's my husband's mother's paintings.
Yes.
So a lot of it's Matthew's.
Patsy Broderick.
A lot of things in there are junk. They're junk. They're special to us, but it's junk.
It's your junk. It's one person's junk.
So thank you for seeing the beauty
it's
in it.
It's beautiful. But really like imagining that van, which is for some reason to me like it's
it was
not
a red and white Volkswagen bus.
Right. Of course
stick
it
shift.
Was. Of course it was.
Which we used as much as possible. We drove that car into the ground and on my birthday of that year, March of that year, the car broke down again on my birthday and we had to get back up to Dobbs Ferry where we had rented a house and my mom drove the car. She was by then here because the baby had been born in February and my dad had taken a shoestring out of one of our shoes, was in the back because Volkswagen vans, the buses, the engines in the back. He had lifted up the top and he was sitting in the back trunk area with a shoelace tied to the engine part that was not working and manually pulling on one of our shoestrings to make it work as my mother drove up the West Side Highway on my birthday. that bus. We like asked everything of cars because we never had a new car.
Right.
We always had a used car. So, anyway.
To be able to take care of your family.
Yes, it's nice.
And to give back in the way that you do must be kind of extraordinary.
It's nice. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much for doing this today.
Oh my God,
it was a pleasure.
For asking so many smart, interesting questions. Somebody's got to do this to you.
All right. Well, maybe it's
you. Who do you think? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, maybe.
Clouds can make the wind blow. Bugs can make the grass grow. So, there you go. These are little known facts that now you know.
If you want more information about my guests, go to the website littleknownfactspodcast.com. I also wanted to tell you that there is now a new addition to the website. It is a button that says contributions. This podcast is a true labor of love, and I really, really want to keep doing it for a long time. So if you like listening as much as I love to do it, please feel free to contribute. It would mean the world to me. Also, on Twitter, you can find me at Alana Levine. Instagram is Little Known Facts Podcast. And on Facebook, Little Known Facts Podcast. You can also feel free to rate and review the show on the iTunes show page. This podcast is recorded at Hanger Studios in New York City. This episode was brought to you by Pro Media. Located in Times Square, Pro Media offers both production and post-production services out of its beautiful studios in the heart of New York City. Pro Media, sound vision. Find out more at promedia.nyc.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.